No, no, someone knows what they're doing.
I know what I'm doing.
What is it?
I have it with a twink.
Oh, of course.
With a twink.
I with a twink. Just I with a twink, apparently.
Yeah, because you're saying, yeah, like...
In a second.
I'll do it fast. Yeah. Good, with a twinkle in my eye.
Like, the first three hits, if you Google it, are Shakespeare, and then it's like, I porn daddy twink videos.
Another episode of Why Did We Watch This? I am your host for this week, Lee Midnight Mushrooms Delahanty.
I'm Brendan, I with a twink, Drishler.
And I'm Chris Strange Fish Ravel.
And if you could not tell from our nicknames this week, we are going to be talking about, rather, Julie Taymor's / William Shakespeare's The Tempest from 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Julie Taymor, written by one William Shakespeare.
What did he do?
Haven't heard. I don't know her.
Starring such people as Helen Mirren as Prosper Ra.
What?
She's a woman? Can someone fetch my monocle? It just popped off my face.
Ghostbusters and now this.
Ben.
The feminists are taking
Wishaw. Wishaw. As Ariel.
Yep.
Digimon Hansu as Caliban. Felicity Jones as Miranda. Going down the list, a lot of other people in this movie. Ruth Carney.
Chris Cooper. David Stratham.
Yeah.
Russell Brand. Alfred Molina.
Yep.
A lot of guys. A lot of guys and girls.
It's a real sausage fest.
Yeah, it is mostly a sausage fest.
We've got a Prospera.
Yep.
Because Miranda barely rates.
Yep.
Before we get too deep in the weeds with this stuff, we did, of course, need to assuage this movie with a drink.
That's
what
right.
What did we have this week?
We had this week something called A Solemn Curfew and Murderous Winds, which was 6 ounces of ginger beer, 4 ounces of cranberry-infused rum, and 1 ounce of lime juice. And I have to say, cranberry-infused rum was very easy to do, because we just got a mason jar, threw some cranberries in with some rum, let it sit for a week, and there you had it.
Yeah. Liquor is very fungible that way. It will kind of just suck up whatever you put in there. So you just let it sit long enough and it'll get enough of that flavor. And now we have a whole bottle of cranberry rum.
That's right. So what'd you guys think?
You know, I'm not really a rum person, and I can't compare it myself to a basic dark and stormy because I don't know that I've ever had one.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a bad drink. For someone that doesn't really drink rum, like, it was an easy drink to down.
Yeah.
I enjoy dark and stormies quite a bit. I don't think this one really tasted like a dark and stormy.
No, not quite.
I think just the cranberry is very strong. You still get some of the ginger and the lime. It's very, very nice. I mean, it's sort of its own thing, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I thought it was very tasty. I thought the cranberry kind of rounds everything out really nicely. Even when we each kind of took a sip of the rum on its own, and normally rum is very harsh to drink on its own, but it went down pretty smooth.
I think if I were doing this again, I would probably use a little more ginger beer in relation to everything else.
Yeah.
Just a bit more. Not nuts, but just enough to get a little bit more of that ginger taste.
Yeah. It did sort of taste, I think, like an old-timey drink. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of... Because it had a bit of fruitiness to it, and it still, you just still had the sort of
bitterness
of alcohol, and the bitterness and the ginger involved, but it kind of reminded me of things like mead, and like, it just kind of seemed like some sort of weird grog that you'd be drinking in Shakespeare's.
Yeah,
it was definitely timely, right?
Yeah, so I think it was a good drink for the movie.
It was a little more traditional than we sometimes go to, which I think is all for the best this time.
Yeah.
We drank it out of some very traditional beaten copper mugs.
Yep.
That was cool.
Yep, got those a while ago and have not had the chance to use them. I'm glad we did.
We're keeping it real tonight.
That's why I'm not wearing pants.
We're back to basics tonight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sing it. So this movie has got to be about something, right?
Has it?
Oh, it sure is.
Can we get a quick rundown of all that goes down to the Tempest?
I'm going to go as quick as I can. I'm going to go as quick as I can.
I'll start the timer right now.
We're using
the synopsis of the play.
But for the most part, the movie does follow the play relatively faithfully, with the exception of obviously Prospera. Yeah.
And there was no summary on the page, on the Wikipedia page.
So,
all right, so the magician Prospero, rightful Duke of Milan, and his daughter Miranda have been stranded for 12 years on an island after Prospero's jealous brother Antonio, aided by Alonso, the King of Naples, deposed him and set him adrift with the 3-year-old Miranda. Gonzalo, Alonso's counselor, had secretly supplied their boat with some food and fresh water, and as well as books that Prospero prizes. Possessing magical powers due to his great learning, Prospero is served by a spirit named Ariel, whom Prospero had rescued from a tree in which Ariel had been trapped by the cruel witch Sycorax after he had refused to obey her. Prospero maintains Ariel's loyalty by repeatedly promising to release the Aerie spirit from servitude. Sycorax had been exiled from Algiers to the island for wreaking havoc with her magic and had died before Prospero's arrival and without releasing Ariel. Sycorax's son, Caliban, a deformed monster and the only non-spiritual inhabitant before the arrival of Prospero, was initially adopted and raised by Prospero. He taught Prospero how to survive on the island, while Prospero and Miranda taught Caliban religion and their own language. In slavery, Caliban has come to view Prospero as a usurper and has grown to resent him and his daughter. Prospero and Miranda in turn view Caliban with disappointment, contempt, and disgust. Prospero only performs one act of magic himself directly on stage. He disarms Ferdinand, causing his nerves to become in their infancy again. The rest of his magic is through controlling spirits, which is how the magicians of the time were believed to operate. Prospero, having divined that his brother Antonio is on a nearby ship, has raised a tempest that causes the passengers to believe they are shipwrecked and marooned. Also on the ship are Antonio's friend and fellow conspirator King Alonso of Naples, Alonso's brother and son, Sebastian and Ferdinand respectively, and Alonso's trusted counselor, Gonzalo. All these passengers are returning from the wedding of Alonso's daughter. Prospero contrives to separate the shipwreck survivors into four different groups. There's three different plots, it says. Prince Ferdinand, who promptly meets the inhabitants Prospero and Miranda. Trinculo and Stefano, who promptly meet Caliban. King Alonso, Sebastian, Antonio Gonzalo, and two attendant lords. And the ship's captain and bosun, who are asleep until the final act.
Real useful fucking characters.
We don't really talk about that in the movie, but
because they're not in there,
Like, they basically, like, at one point in the play, it's like, all right, wake them up and get the boat back.
These three plots then alternate on stage throughout the play. In one, Caliban falls in love with Stefano and Trinculo, two drunkards believing Stefano to be a brave god who bears celestial liquor. They attempt to raise a coup against Prospero, which ultimately fails. In another, Prospero works to encourage a romantic relationship between Ferdinand and Miranda, and the two fall immediately in love, but Prospero worries that this is happening too quickly and compels Ferdinand to become his servant, pretending that he regards him as a spy. In the third subplot, Antonio and Sebastian conspire to kill Alonso and Gonzalo so that Sebastian can become king. Ariel thwarts them at Prospero's command. Ariel appears to the three men of sin as a harpy reprimanding them for their betrayal of Prospero. Prospero has witnessed this, leaves to visit Ferdinand and Miranda. The three guilty nobles run off, distracted and in a frenzy, and Gonzalo and the attendant lords chase after to prevent them from doing with what ecstasy may now provoke them to do. Prospero then explains that he tested Ferdinand and betrothed a willing Miranda to him. He then asks Ariel to bring some other spirits and create a mask to entertain the young couple. That doesn't happen in the movie, so we're going to skip it. Prospero suddenly remembers the plot against his life, dismisses the show, and Miranda and Ferdinand set traps for Caliban, Trinculo, and Stefano. They are chased off stage by goblins in the shape of hounds. Prospero, all his enemies in power, discovers that Ariel would pity them if they were human and decides to forgive the people who tried to kill him. He tells Ariel to fetch the nobles while he breaks his charms. In the conclusion, the main characters are brought together before Prospero, who forgives Alonso, Antonio, and Sebastian. Ariel is changed to prepare the proper sailing weather to guide the king's ship back to the royal fleet and then to Naples, where Ferdinand and Miranda will be married. After discharging this task, Ariel will finally be free. Prospero pardons Caliban, who was sent to prepare Prospero's cell, to which Alonso and his party are invited for a final night before their departure. However, it is not made clear whether after this departure Caliban will remain on the island or whether he will be taken to Naples. Prospero indicates that he intends to entertain them with the story of his life on the island. Prospero has resolved to break and bury his magic staff and drown his book of magic, and in his epilogue, shorn of his magical powers, he invites the audience to set him free from the island with their applause.
Yep.
Guys, that was a
that was a real who.
So, I mean, we've covered that is going to be some of this. Not all stuff is going to apply.
Right. Obviously, person. Again, the biggest thing, there's a gender swap.
Yep, there's a big gender swap. So let's open our discussion with the bigger decisions that Julie Taymor made in interpreting the play. And there's a couple bullet points that I want to cover here. Mm-hmm. The first one being making Prospero into Prospera, which I think is probably the best thing about this movie.
I absolutely agree.
I think it enriches the character so much more. I think it's more interesting that the character is female. I think it makes more sense. You kind of see why this character kind of like robbed of their power would turn to something else to try to make them feel more powerful.
I think if this character, if Prospero were not Prospero, there would be very little reason to seek out this movie version.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that is like the thing it has going for it. If you're going to watch this version, it's because you want to see that.
Yeah, and we'll cover it in more depth later, but Helen Mirren is like the second part of that.
She fucking kills.
Nails that part.
The role.
So, real quick to cover like how they sort of pull this off successfully, like it's not really a lot required, but they do sort of tweak some of the beginning setup, where I believe they do state that, like, she wasn't the Duke.
Right.
But she had a husband that was the Duke, and she was just sort of, like, a smart, studious person.
But when the Duke died, his position was left to her in his will.
Yeah. But, like, a lot of the other stuff is the same. Like, even in the original, Prospero is described as, like, enjoying studying and learning a lot. And so I think a lot of those lines are lifted directly, and they just sort of adjust. There's, like, a couple lines they add, one of them, interestingly, about, like, how... when she's talking about how her brother accuses her of witchcraft, that, like, you know, other people of my sex have been burned for
at the stake for that accusation.
Things of, like, yeah, and that's an interesting layer to throw right in there. If you're, like, I'm not, like, people have different, I guess, degrees of how far they'll go with Shakespeare, and I'm totally fine with adding, subtracting.
Me too.
We're gonna talk about it in a couple weeks, too, with, like, other adaptations of Shakespeare, and I think, like, there's a lot you can do with just his stories, whether or not how far you take his language.
In my experience, taking his stories from stage to film, you kind of have to change some things.
Well, I mean, if only by dint of the fact that your movie would be 5 hours long, certainly.
Yes.
Like, you have to.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, even plays, like, nowadays, that cut so much.
You're right.
Because it's unnecessary. And there's a lot that's just not, you don't need to do it.
Right, no.
Yeah.
Yeah,
theater was a different thing back
then. Yeah, you can get away with less now.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's also something to be said that Shakespeare's plays are so adaptable, and I almost feel like they're ideal for kind of molding around a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the good things about doing Shakespeare, is I think that you have a lot of freedom and decisions that you have to make. And there's a lot of difference. The variety of adaptations you get, it can be enriching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, with Prospera, really, all that they really do substantially is that beginning bit where they kind of set it up a little bit differently.
Right.
And the rest of that, like, that's all that you have to do. And the rest of that change is just implicit in the decision to have Prospero be a woman. Like, it's just more powerful to see a lot of the stuff that happens to Prospero happening to a woman.
Yeah.
My favorite bit, I think, is watching... Because, I mean, there's a lot that I love about the original story in general. Because I think that there's a lot that people like to talk about famously about... This was Shakespeare's one of his last plays that he at least wrote by himself. And a lot of people layer onto that this idea that... It's a meta level of Shakespeare talking about giving up writing.
Yeah, right.
Because there is a lot of bits about Prospero having to give up his power to find peace in life.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there's a lot of meditation around death approaching and, like...
Mm-hmm. Meditation around death, a meditation about, like, to what extent has he exploited things in his life.
Yeah.
For this power, for this thing.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this, like, weird mixed emotional bag, right? Because he's... acknowledging the things that it's given him while acknowledging the things that it's also taken away.
Yeah. We'll get into, like, Caliban and all that, but there's also a level of, like, guilt and shame, I think, involved in that to some extent. But for me, I think the decision to have her be a woman is most powerful when, the fact that this is a woman who has been robbed of her agency in ways that women commonly are today and in the past, and so therefore has found another way to gain power, and then to watch her decide to give that power up in favor of, like, because again, whether it's the original or this, like, it's all of this is stuff that she's doing really not for herself, but more for her daughter.
Yeah.
It's very meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think it's more meaningful that she gave herself this power and then she gives it up.
Yeah.
At the end. I also think the relationship with Miranda plays better when it's a woman, because the way I read it as, she had this wall of shit fall on her as being a woman in this world. She wants to protect her daughter from having the same thing happen to her.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a father, I feel like it can play off as, like, covetous or...
It's also kind of weird if when it's her father, like, forcibly putting her to sleep.
Yeah.
It's
a little uncomfy.
Yeah. There's a lot of weirdness with that.
Yeah.
That I have not remembered.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's probably the first big thing that's changed. The second that we should probably talk about is... the decision, and this is not probably, like, she's not alone in making this decision and interpretation, but Caliban is the only person of color in the movie.
Yes.
And very much depicted by Digimon Hatsu as, like...
A savage
and, like, right. A native of the island.
Yes, he wears a loincloth. He's very sort of, like, he has a lot of physicality about him that's kind of, like, a lot of squatting.
And the way he speaks, like, he speaks in a very effective way.
Yeah, he's very, like, subservient to everyone who comes up to him, kind of, like...
Yeah.
It, regarding this, like, clever white man as a god kind of thing, too.
Well, I mean, that's just in the... Like, I get a lot of that as text, but the way that he does it, And, like, his physicality is very animalistic and, like...
He's, like, it's a lot of squatting, kind of. Like, even, like, even he's kind of, like, this. Like, he's not really standing up. He's kind of hunched over.
Yeah. He lopes.
He hunches a lot as well.
Yeah.
There is, I believe, there's a theatrical tradition that she's referencing in that, I don't know if it's done anymore, but for a while, that was considered one of the, like, black roles that you could cast in a Shakespeare
play. I think that's more of a contemporary notion than it was...
I mean, at the time, I just mean, like...
And even now, it wouldn't be the same as, like, casting a white person as Othello. It would be, it's like, you can choose to see it that way. So I don't know if I would say it's something inherent in the text.
Yeah, I don't think this is inherent
in the text. I just mean, like, I think she's picking up on something that had already been done.
Yeah.
No, it's been, it is. That, you don't have to think that. You can know that. Like, there's, like, a common, in the 50s, I think this interpretation first came out, of, like, viewing Caliban through a post-colonial lens of, like, this is maybe Shakespeare's commenting. I mean, I doubt, like, let's face it,
we had talked a little bit about that. Yeah.
Like, I did it a little bit before we recorded, but, like, yes, there is a common, this is, like, there's a big essay about it. I cannot have it on hand, but, like, you can find it. Someone wrote extensively about viewing this through, like, a post-colonial lens of, like, Caliban being an exploited native.
Mm-hmm.
And how this was technically happening around the time of Shakespeare's life. And if you want to try to... Julie Tamor can either do, like, what she thinks Shakespeare meant or what she sees. Both of those are valid.
Right.
But, like, hot take, guys, if you are doing it as Shakespeare intended, I don't think he probably had a lot of great things to say about race.
Nope.
No, and we were also, is like, I don't think that this was supposed to be a remark on, like, oh, look at colonialism, how this affects
us. Yeah, first of all, it's literally just like,
That's much more of a modern
It literally never crossed his mind.
Yeah.
You go to an island, there's a weird thing there. Well, he's trying to, like, rape your daughter. I guess we got to enslave him.
Oh, my God. Well, and so the thing is, there is evidence in some of his other, well, in Othello, to suggest that Shakespeare did at least find racism to be distasteful.
But I think
he's still ignorant in the way that, like...
Someone at his time would have been ignorant.
Yes.
You can't really, we can't really look back and imagine that he had some sort of amazing lens.
Like, yeah,
He is not by any stretch of the imagination enlightened as we would see it on that issue.
But an interesting point of order is that I don't think that he got to the island and they raped him right away. What happens is...
Right, no, I know.
They do, like... imply that they took him in.
Right.
And then he learned stuff for a while and then, like, went after the daughter.
Yeah.
And then, therefore, after was kind of, like, scorned and kicked around.
Right. Yeah. And he has to lug logs in all the time.
Yeah. Always getting firewood.
I question Julia Taymor invoking it in this movie because I don't know what her statement is.
Yeah. And again, I want to come back to Caliban with acting, but it's weird to me that Digimon Hansu does it the way he does it.
I suspect I know what Julie Chanmore is trying to say. I don't think she says it, though. Like,
What do you think she's trying to say?
I think she's trying to portray Caliban as some sort of sympathetic light.
Yes, but it doesn't.
Because, again, if you're not willing to massively deviate from the text of The Tempest as it stands now, you can't portray him in an entirely sensitive light.
I think you can, though. But it's not in the way that I think that Julie Chanmore wants to do. Mm-hmm. I feel like Julie Chanmore wanted to have it...
Both ways.
Too many ways.
Yeah.
Whereas in the play, I don't think that Caliban is portrayed as like a one or even two dimensional villain character. I think that he's portrayed much in the same way as Prospero, as like someone that has both been wronged and done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot to Caliban that is like naive and doesn't know what's happening, like innocent and you know, just natural. Like he's just a human being that does things. And whether or not he meant to do harm in certain aspects or whether or not he, like, was just, you know, learning how to interact with the world is up for debate in some ways. But also, I think that he clearly has done things. Like, he does conspire with Trinculo and Stefano because he is angry. But the sum of that anger is justified because he has been treated so wrongly.
Yes.
So it's really just more like... I think it is a nuanced character in the play in terms of, like, it's easy to humanize him. Because he does, you know, you can see that he's much like anyone else, where, like, maybe if he'd been left alone, none of this would have happened in the first place.
There is that. I think the problem that comes from the movie is that there's no real resolution to his story.
Not really.
As you said...
There are lines they cut where she pardoned... Well, where Prospero pardoned Caliban.
And it's supposed to, by the way, assume that pardon is implied when she just sort of looks at
him. I think so, yeah.
I think that was Julie Taymor trying to tell without saying explicitly.
I don't dig her for it, necessarily.
I feel like I would have preferred a little more if they had included that in the movie.
Do they include this thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine?
She does say that? Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, there's not a lot of like wrap up for that sort of thing. And as someone was saying, or I can't remember if it was while we were doing the synopsis or beforehand, they don't ever explicitly state if he is coming with them, like if they're going to take him back.
They don't say that in the play either.
Right. No, that's what I meant. I mean, in the play doesn't, and therefore the movie doesn't either. So like, you know, I feel like if you were trying to wrap it up in some way, you might want to include like, well, he's going to stay on the island now. We're going to leave him as he was.
I honestly think in however you adapt it, I feel like you should not leave it vague. I feel like the play leaves it vague for someone to do as they wish. I don't think the play leaves it vague so that no one ever knows.
I feel like I would, honestly, I feel like I would have never read this and assumed that they were taking Caliban with
them. No, I think
I would assume he's staying there.
Yeah.
It would be a really weird choice if I saw a production where they like, at the end, they like, pull him on a rope or like, oh, come on, buddy, we're getting on the boat.
And it would be like Pocahontas 2, where it's like, I'm living in the new world now.
Oh, that would be such a fun movie to see.
Caliban and Naples.
Caliban and Nepali.
So I think, I mean, all right, I guess technically, and not as big of a deal, but Ariel is typically a female, as Prospero is typically a man, but there's really not a crazy amount. I think it's a good casting choice to have Kamal Shah as him.
Yes.
But it's potentially could be seen as like a choice that Julie Taymor made. I think I'll talk about this in my fix, I guess, but I think I would always prefer to keep them opposite genders for that.
Yeah, I think especially also if you're making Prospero a woman, it is a good choice to make Ariel a male.
Yeah.
I love their dynamic.
Yeah, I like it, and I like some of the decisions, like, because I think some of it's Ben O'Shaw, I think some of it's the text, some of it is the interpretation, but I feel like there's a lot of things you could do with Ariel. You could go alien and exotic and different, or you could go, like, this is more of a human character, and I think that they lean into the more other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Ben O'Shaw as Ariel is definitely, like...
A hairless Ken doll.
Yeah, a hairless Ken doll, but, like, the way he acts, he doesn't act human, really. Yeah. There's, like, moments of empathy and humanity shining through, but, like, they're, like, he's jittery and, like, he's, like, flighty and is all over the place. Like, he doesn't act like a person. Which is a choice, and I think it's a valid way to see him, but...
Mm-hmm. I think any real issues I have with Ariel as a character are more at the fault of direction than they are of Ben O'Shaw.
Yeah.
Like, the weirdness, like... Again, like, the first big scene you get with him, he comes out of the water, and she's like, so, did you make the Tempest? He's like, did I make the Tempest?
And then we cut to him, like, this
electric guitar riff as an enormous Ariel is in the ocean, like, with the boat on fire. And he's, like, tapping with his fingers, causing it to go up in flames. And there's, like, at one point, three of him surrounding the boat, and they're all, like, laughing and, like,
I think that's the design and the effects decision.
Yes.
I think it's just bad.
Well, Julie Taymor has never met an After Effects she didn't use repeatedly. Yeah.
I think the worst of the After Effects are on Ariel, though. Because when you see him like go up into the sky or kind of like flit around, it's like that stupid boxy like ghost effect happening.
Well, I want to talk about staging, but since we're talking about it now, let's go into the effects and the design choices made.
Okay.
So you've got Ariel is always naked.
Yep.
Naked, but with no penis.
No dick.
He's
not hanging dong. He's got a smooth.
But mostly, see it. The only reason that we know he has no penis is because of like a really one quick shot. But like he's deliberately shot from the waist.
There's a handful of them. Like, and
I see his butt a lot.
Yeah, you do see a lot of butt. So if you want to see that wish shot butt,
if you want to see that,
here's a movie
but
for
he's
you.
Kind of like translucent. Like he's never fully present.
There are a lot of times where he is literally see through, where you just get like part of his body in the frame.
Yeah,
but there are a handful of times, most notably. Again, in his initial scene where he, like, jumps around really quickly, you see his smooth very briefly. And then again, whenever he's...
That's upsetting.
That's what it is.
You want to touch my smooth.
Touch my smooth. And then again, when he's putting the king and Gonzalo to sleep.
You guys were also suggesting that he had some sort of imp? Like...
What?
Prosthetic breasts?
It looked like it in
Not in all the scenes. When he's playing the harpy, which I think because harpies are kind of like a female creature.
When he's playing the harpy, but
and
also
when he's
wearing that
song.
Like skirt.
I didn't notice that
wig.
At all.
I was staring at it.
I thought that was his chest.
Well, okay, so in most shots, he has a very flat chest.
Right.
Okay.
In the sexy water song and in the harpy moment, It's more clear in the harpy moment because they're kind of shooting it head on. In Sexy Water Song, there's a lot of water movement, so I wasn't sure for a second. I'm like,
am I just fantasizing this?
Finally, all my dreams come true. Ben Whishaw with a pair of eight cups. Yeah.
with the breasts of a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
But, like, they're very small, but they're there. And yeah. I think they're coming out in those two moments because that's when he's leaning into a more feminine aspect.
We also, you said he was wearing a longer wig, which I did notice.
Yes.
His hair was longer in one of the scenes.
It's flowing, yeah.
Yeah. But for the most part, he's sort of like he's a twink.
Yeah, he is.
He's a twink. He's a transparent twink.
No,
listen.
This entire movie is like a gay Fantasia, where it's just like, you have like this hardcore crazy ass bitch on an island with a little daughter. She has two slaves, one of whom is a hairless twink, the other one is like such a top.
Yeah.
And then
he's a muscle daddy.
Yeah. And then she has this entire boat of men crash up on her shores, including Reeve Carney the hyper twink,
yep.
Alan Cumming, and a bunch of other just like randos on her beaches.
He had some men.
Yeah, no, again, yeah, yes, yeah. He did. And so, like, this is her motherfucking island,
yeah.
And these are her men swarming,
yeah,
babies.
Yeah, it's like a Dakota movie.
Yeah, yes, I was just about to
yeah.
say,
well,
I was
no,
like...
You just need to see Ben Whishaw and Tidy Whiteys throughout the entire time.
Hello?
Like, hello? Is someone there?
And then a knife just flies
yeah.
out in front of his face, and we cut to the next scene.
Which, I'd be fine with. That's my... Guys, that's my fix, right there.
I gotta be honest, I loved that aspect of this movie, that it's like, yeah, I mean, just... I would want to be the gay dude serving this, like, really powerful sorceress. Like, that sounds great!
Again, this is your specific fantasy here.
It really is.
I do think it plays well because, again, with Prospero being Prospera, it becomes a more, like, sort of... I don't know. I don't want to say like necessarily more nuanced, but it becomes a more obvious comment on, like, these men in relation to this woman, I think, than it would if it were just, like, this old guy and his daughter. You know, you think about it a lot more when it's a woman at the center of all of this.
There's also, on a certain level, it's just refreshing to see them do something different with it. Because I feel like this would have been 1,000% more boring had they just played it straight. In both senses of the word.
So we got Ariel's effects. Caliban is sort of like there's some skin work being done.
So
some of it is
biggest
like,
thing to notice is that he has patches of like
white
almost
skin.
Albino white skin.
Albino, and one of his eyes is blue.
Yes.
But like a
because of the white patch.
Blue.
Yeah.
And he's also got like
rock
dragon scale.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it looks like dragon scale from Game of Thrones. And he has words carved into him that
yeah,
I
yeah, like runic stuff.
Yeah, I don't know.
I missed that on the first pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
got web fingers. So that's that.
Are they webbed?
Yeah, they're
a little
bit webbed, which is the only reason I can think of is why they're like, hey, fish?
Well,
are you a fish?
The fish is from the play, right?
No, I know
I think
it
that's
is.
That's just generic fill-in to be like, this is a weird looking dude. And, like, I have seen a picture, and I showed you guys.
Yeah,
like,
where he's, like, a fish man.
A fish man.
And,
yeah.
And like,
but I've also
like
seen...
a foot tall.
I've also seen, like, you know, there's a lot... I think Caliban is probably where you'll get the most diverse in how people do it. And, like,
yeah.
I've seen, like, a beast man version where he's got, like, super long hair. I've seen just, like, a big fat man. You know, that, like, you know, like a...
Ew, a fatty?
Grotesque proportions, like...
Not on Prospera's island, bitches!
Like, thin thighs, massive calves for no reason. Just, like, you know, a man of, like, that, of just weird...
They're just, like, giving weird monster features. Like,
no, but only
like Torgo and Manos has a fate.
Or,
big knees? All right.
Yeah.
You could almost take it in, like, a Frankenstein direction, right? Where it's just, like, almost like a weird, like...
Yeah, like a hodgepodge of body parts. And, like, I think that's sort of, like, that's where you'll get crazy, but... it's an interesting choice. I have thoughts about, for my fix, how that would work, but I don't think that it's too much effect in the movie. Like, they kind of imply, again, in the movie, theoretically, or in the play, rather, this is a human.
Right.
Sort of.
Right.
But also, they call it a devil a lot, but, like,
yeah.
That it was a child born of this witch.
Right.
And so, like, there's a lot of implication that, like, because it's a witch-born child, that, like, it's not fully human.
And there's some other stuff involved.
Yeah, and they imply a couple times that, like, you know, it doesn't really... It's not, like, his fault, per se, that he's such an evil thing, because he was born out of evil or whatever.
Yes.
They imply that sometimes, and then also they imply that, like, you know, that there was maybe a humanity to him.
Are we to believe that he has sort of upturned that expectation by the end of the play? Like shown that he's not evil.
Do you think that Julie Taymor wants us to think that?
Yes.
Possibly. I don't think we do.
Oh, I don't think we
I
do
think,
at all, but I'm just wondering, was that her intention?
I think I kind of got into this a little bit earlier on, too. I think it is a mistake. I know you had said that the only person of color is basically him.
Yep.
I think it is a mistake to have him so obviously resemble a black guy.
It's really, like, it's a bad choice.
Because it feels like she's trying to say something, but I can't quite put my finger on what precisely she is accomplishing by doing this. Like, it raises more questions to me than it answers.
Yeah.
And so, like, if her goal was to make me, sit there and think, interesting, then, mission accomplished. If her goal was actually to cause me to arrive at a conclusion, I have not done so.
Fashion is nuts. And I kind of love it.
I actually unabashedly
it's
love
nuts
it.
And I don't care. Listen, guys,
it's a fantasy.
Shakespeare, I don't care what time it is, I don't care what year it is, I just want to see that clothing.
It is a fantasy, and they are giving us some of it is great. Like, I love the leather and the zippers.
Yeah, there's a lot of zippers. A lot of things just don't exist.
Yeah, everyone from the noblemen from Milan all have zippers all over their outfits.
But it's also very streamlined and smooth lines and crisp and form fitting.
Yes.
And
it's like zippers as you would have pinstripes almost.
Yeah.
It looks like they're stripes, but they're just zippers.
But it's also playing on something because they would have those breastplates, this kind of conquistador black.
Yeah, well, there's
black.
There's a rough collar, but it's very modern looking.
Yeah.
So there's elements of Shakespearean fashion, but with modern cuts.
Only part where it falls flat for me is on Reeve Carney wearing that stupid racer back.
He's just wearing
tank top and black jeans.
Anna Miranda, to some extent, is just sort of wearing a peasant
rags.
I think. I'm mostly fine with Miranda up until the end when she comes out in that weird screen printed dress.
Yeah, she was
it's got a face on it.
And
yeah,
it looks like it's the Virgin Mary or something.
Or I was thinking almost like Birth of Venus, but it's a weird it's a weird decision to have there be an obviously printed face on her dress.
Yeah, it reminded me of my favorite trash history show, Rain, where everyone was wearing screen printed patterned dresses all the time.
Yeah. I gotta say, I think my favorite, everyone's gonna say Prospero, and that's fine, she's wearing Grayskull clothing, but I also really love Trinculo's outfit / Russell Brand's outfit.
Mm. It's good.
I like his, bizarre, it's like Ford Prefect in the 80s adaptation, where he's just, wearing, stripes and plaid and, a red scarf that clashes with the yellow shirt.
It's very singular in its look, because no one else on the island is dressed in those colors, pretty much.
Yeah, and it looks good on his body, it's tailored well to him, because it's, he's lanky and long, and, the tails are very long, and the scarf is so thin. And there's a scene I really love where they're, dancing off into the wilderness, where there's, it's a silhouette shot, and, he's just sort of doing this, weird ribbon dancing stuff,
it's
and it
great.
Looks, almost like a cartoon. He doesn't look like a normal human in that shot.
His physicality was great.
Yeah.
I had no problem with that. But you mentioned it. Prospera, she wears this amazing cloak.
Crazy cloak.
She wears this, cool, dark
sea
faded
blue
and peacock. With the weird fur / seaweed.
Distressed.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It looks awesome.
Yep.
And she looks great.
And then she has her own Zipper Milan outfit.
I love it.
In the end.
I too would like to join Zipper Milan.
Yeah. It does seem like there is, because there is, I think, a moment that I feel like Julie Taymor wants you to pay attention to whenever Ariel is putting the corset on her and he ties and she goes it feels like Julie Taymor is saying something
it feels like it's very heavy.
It does. No, it's not a subtle thing at all, but it's she's being bound in the clothes
it's
that
about
she wants
as subtle
to wear.
As the green light in Jay Gatsby.
Wait, what does that mean?
What is the green light?
It means stop, right?
Yeah.
Green light means stop. so, because there's a quick scene wherever he's dressing her, and you get a moment of her as he tightens her corset, and it's a little on the nose.
It's a little on the nose. I agree. Well,
Julie Taymor, we get it.
Yeah.
I almost feel at some point she couldn't help herself, and she would keep doing those kind of jokes.
To be fair, Julie Taymor is very talented, but I feel like she does not know when to stop.
She's indulgent. She's talented, but she's very indulgent.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what other crazy effects. Oh, there's a lot of bad CGI.
Yes.
There is. The dogs. The demon dogs.
The
hellhound dogs.
Are probably the worst thing for me in the movie effect-wise. So whenever Trinculo and Caliban are being chased away, and Alfred Millian, whose name I forget.
They come out of the fire pit.
Yeah, they come out of a little pit, and it's these really terrible, Everworld cover CGI dogs who don't have any weight or heft to them, so they don't move in the way a dog would actually move.
Mm-hmm.
They just look like they're superimposed over the screen. They're just kind of always bouncing around.
They don't make any efforts to show them impacting with the ground.
They really don't at all. So it looks like they are the after effect that they are. Had it just been,
a smoke,
balls of fire.
A smoke monster.
Even just smoke monster. There you go. Crib from Lost. I would have been completely fine with it. The fact that they try and make it look at all like a living creature really takes me out of the moment.
It's dumb.
Yeah. And the best thing that they do, I think, is when they turn Ariel into a harpy and he sort of gives them the bad news about, we know what you did and you're going to hell for it.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
It's just, because mostly
it's
practical effects. And he's in black.
Yeah.
He's got tar in his teeth.
Yeah.
And he's got these wings that are
he's
his own
squatting
arms.
On a rock, kind of, so he looks bird-like.
The hair
weird.
Is all kind of messed up. I think
he
has different contacts in. It's a great look.
Yeah. The problem with that scene that I have is then again, when Julie Taymor, when Julie Taymor uses that slow-mo effect, whenever they're all fighting the crows away with their swords.
Yeah,
it's like,
just like,
slow-mo, blurring, oh no, it's just like...
It was like Girl from Monday all over again.
Right, just because you can do it doesn't mean you have to do it. So this is a lesson that she must learn and has not yet learned.
I don't like a lot of the camera effects.
I'll also say it's a bummer because I feel like the camera effects actually kind of spoil what I feel to be, at least in at their concept, really solid visual choices.
Her lack of restraint damages a lot of the movie in this.
Yes. Yeah. I actually feel like if she had pulled back on the throttle a little bit, we could have gotten... some restraint, I think, would have let a lot of these images breathe more.
Yeah.
And so, for example, I think the harpy scene could have been flawless if not for, let's put on some more effects here.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's probably covers it for effects. I want to cover really quickly... I don't want to go too depth into the next two topics, but... back to the adaptation in terms of like how they adapted it, staging and alterations. I know that both to some extent we all feel like this, that it is too long and that a lot of it is boring.
Yes.
I think it's unfortunate. I will say, like, the play is way worse. If you'd watch the play as is, you'd be miserable.
I have.
But I think she does a pretty good job at a base level of, like, getting all of the stuff that you need in there and cutting where you need to. I mean, like, she cuts, she knows what lines are the meatiest, which is not, like, hard to know if you're, like, actually at all reading Shakespeare on a regular
she
basis.
She cuts whole characters that need to be cut.
Yeah. She does that. She's good with, like, moving scenes around. Like, the decision to, I think it's really bizarre and sort of backwards the way that, like, she... Like, Ariel has no final line or farewell in the play. Like, but because in the movie, they take a line that he has earlier where he sort of, like, sings a happy song as he flies away.
Mm-hmm.
And they place it right after she says, like, go free.
Yeah.
In the play, he just sort of says, be free. And that's the end of the play. And I'm like, I guess, like, it's up to staging to save the day there. But I like the decision to mix bits around and not be afraid to change lines and cut in certain places. I think that there are some things that you could cut from some of these subplots, but unfortunately, like, the play doesn't stand on its own without having Caliban and Trinculo and Stefano do the things they do.
No,
like,
and I'm not saying that, like, those must be cut entirely. I think that she just should have used a more judicious hand in knowing what to cut from there. There are moments...
I don't really need, like, 3 minutes of Stefano singing drunkenly.
Yeah, again, it's just, like, that the shtick with the blanket, wherever Trinculo is hiding under
that
blanket.
That was staged so badly.
Oh, no, it's terrible. So here's the
interminable,
right. It's interminably long. The other problem is that it should be dark, because they mentioned specifically storm clouds coming in. It's like... I don't know, 6 p.m. or something, basically.
Make it apparent that everyone is drunk off their asses.
Right.
Because, like, it's, like, so stupid. Yeah, there's, like, it's just, like, you come in to see, like, clearly a man on another man's crotch and a blanket from
with a blanket, like, half a blanket, too, so it's not covering all of them.
And
it's
having another character be like, what could it be?
Yeah, what's this weird thing?
You're gonna fucking tell me you don't recognize those are Trinculo's pants.
Yeah, like, it's clearly your friend from the boat.
I would also say...
It's also, like, it's clearly a blanket. Like, why don't you just pull it off and be like, what's going on down here?
It's tiresome because we reach that conclusion so much...
It's dragged out.
So much earlier than they do. Yeah. So it just feels painful to have to go through the motions to get there with them.
Yeah.
I also think...
I feel like it's like maybe they didn't think... They didn't adapt it for a modern audience. They just sort of feel like, well, people in the 1600s...
I thought this was hilarious.
Hilarious. Height of comedy.
Yep.
Just three idiots on stage.
I also just find... I feel like it's... They... You can kind of break down their adventures, I feel, into kind of like three events... But they're so fucking repetitive, where it's like, we're drunk, Caliban's worshiping up us like a god, we're being silly, because it's like, it's the blanket, it's the one where Ariel is throwing Trinculo's voice, and then it's the clothing one. They're so repetitive, and I feel like
there is also the really super weird one, wherever they're in the swamps, and Trinculo falls over, and a bunch of frogs jump out, some of whom look like Ariel.
One of them lands on his hand,
and it's a normal frog.
He stares at it.
Yeah, and then the frog looks away and it gets Ariel's face as it turns its head away, which
is like that Google Deep
Weird
video. It's
It's just, I find it to be so repetitive and uninteresting that I feel like maybe a good idea would have been to trim or combine.
Yeah, I think part of it is the decision not to do anything that adventurous with the characters.
Yeah.
I
would have been fine with it being that number of scenes. I just feel that every scene as it is goes on too long. The other issue, of course, is the Miranda Ferdinand scene.
Boring!
And I get, because there's only, like, really two scenes, right? There's, like, the first scene where they meet, there's the scene of him carrying sticks, and then at the end, she's like, all right, well, let's get you two married. So, that's fine, right? That's all you really need. That said, the second scene is the interminable one for me. I think, like, for someone who is so in love with cinematic techniques, Julie Taymor did not think to just show a montage of, like, him carrying sticks and Miranda being like, hmm, and then, like, him going back down.
I guess.
Exactly. Like, So, like, that scene in particular could have been abbreviated in some way that would have kept things moving a lot quicker, and I think the movie would have been better for it.
It's hard to sell because, like, honestly, like, it's hard to sell in the play.
Right.
It's supposed to, like, really the play is about Prospero. It's not about these two dumb idiots that fall in love within seconds. Yeah. And it's just it's a plot device for Prospero. It's like, it's one of the parts of his plan. It's like step one out of five of his plan to get back to Milan. Yeah.
I'd also put out there, I don't think Julie Taymor was terribly successful in many ways. I think she was more successful in others, but I think this play is hard to make into a film, I think primarily because it's not very plot-driven. It's very slow and meditative. The plot is sort of secondary to the monologues, especially Prospero's, and it seems to be more kind of serving a meandering through an idea more than it's actually, like, giving you an interesting plot. So I think then when you put that on screen and you don't accelerate any enough of it, it drags, and it starts to feel very long.
I wonder if perhaps if Prospero was playing more of a prominent role in the scene, in the second scene between Ferdinand and Miranda, if it would have somehow played better, if there was the idea that, like, she's the one manipulating them to be.
It's supposed to be. He's supposed to be there.
Right, yeah, no, but, like, the only time you see Prospero is, like, whenever Reeve Carney is scrambling with his sticks, like, the camera pans up, and you see her kind of, like, standing up there, and she just, like, walks away real quick. So, like, if more of the scene was shot from, like, this is what she's seeing of them together, perhaps it would have felt a little more integrated into the movie. But as it stands now, it's this aside of these two characters whom I don't really care about, but I get why I have to care about them for the plot to work.
I mean, like, the most prominent characters in this play are Prospero and Ariel.
Yeah.
They have the most lines, they have the most to do.
And consequently, they are the most interesting to watch in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's finally get to, really quickly before we go into fixes, let's talk about
acting!
Acting! Helen Mirren is fucking amazing.
I mean, let's start there. She's
great.
Her performance is astounding. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. She's so good.
She plays really well off Ben Whishaw as well.
I think I love their dynamic. I love their chemistry. I'll say this again. I loved their, like, twink serving a powerful woman energy. It was great.
On a staging note, I do like how, and again, because this is sort of, like, not really that, this is the same in the play, but the way they do it, I like, where whenever Prospero in the movie is sort of, like, talking to herself, she's really talking to Ariel, whether or not it was in the play or not. Like, it's Ariel's just always there. Like, his little face will just, like, appear behind her or whatever. And I like the little, like, looks that they'll share when they're, like, doing something. I wish they kind of did more of that, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
With Ariel being an invisible character, I kind of wish there was just more of Ariel in general.
Yeah.
As a witness and as reacting to things. But there's that. The way that she delivers the final monologue with the fire circle is one of my favorite things.
It's so good. Ivan Kalamirin also plays the, like, almost affectionate regret she has of, like, letting Ariel go and maybe even realizing, like, I've enslaved this thing that I've come to love.
Yeah, I like the way that she delivers the line so. Which is how it is in the play, but, like, the way it's, like, very, the way that it's, like, there's a lot of weight with every one of those words,
because
it's what she says when she's fully zipped up and turned to zippered clothing, and she's about to, like, approach her, like, oppressors, not oppressors, I guess, but, like,
well, her brother who betrayed her betrayers,
opponents, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, you know, get back to her old life. It's sort of, like, a bittersweet, like, moment of, like, this is where I get what I want, but also I lose things that I had.
Ben Whishaw, I think, does a great job.
Yeah.
I think he has a really tough character to play. It's not one with a very clear, or I guess maybe not a super accessible personality, but I think he does a very good job of playing it as this kind of alien, sprightly creature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of that is the look, right? But I think his physicality is really good. When he's all kind of twisted up and gnarled, the way he holds his body when he's standing is really good. It's always... he's always kind of vacillating between being hunched over or very open, which I found very fascinating.
Well, there's also a lot of, like, crawling and, like just you know, like, curled up into a weird ball or just, like, hunched over next to people, that sort of thing. So, again, similar to how Callahan is always sort of subservient, but it's in a very different style. It's, like, a very more sort of accommodating, like crouch down because he's no physical threat versus Caliban, who looks like he's ready to, like, smack.
He also does a lot of, like,
much more pliant
and, like, eye acting. Like, like, the way the looks that he'll give Prosper are very meaningful. Caliban, I have complicated things about.
I think Digimon Hansu acts this character well.
Yes, I don't think
the character is good.
I think he's
very straight. Delivers strong performance.
Yes, he does.
I don't really like the direction it's taken.
No,
I don't know how much of that's on him and how much of that's on Tamor.
I'm willing to fault Tamor mostly. I feel like I've seen Tamor make a lot of bizarre big choices before, so I'm going to say it's probably up to her.
Likewise, yeah. I think he puts in very solid work. I think he does a great job. I just don't like what it was.
I do like the one again. I think this is where Tamor is really trying to drive home that is a sympathetic portrayal, but it's a good monologue in the play where he talks about how wondrous the island is and the sounds mm-hmm. that it makes and that's a good monologue.
This is the last thing I'll say, but he communicates a lot of warmth when he talks about the island.
Yeah.
Especially when he's like, I'll show you the best places. You get really the sense that he loves his home a lot.
Yeah. I guess honorable mentions for people that I think did their parts well, whether or not their parts were important or mattered a lot, but Alan Cumming.
Yeah.
We all wish that Alan Cumming and Chris
Cooper switched roles.
Yeah.
Because Alan Cumming's a much better mastermind.
Yeah, he has a lot more fun playing evil than Chris Cooper. Chris Cooper is a good actor, but he's just miscast.
And
in this
weirdness
movie.
Is that Alan Cumming is playing evil but dumb.
Yeah.
He's kind of a little thick on the uptake.
Yeah.
Which. He should play devious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He should play cunning.
He plays more opportunistic and but slow in the uptake.
Yeah.
I don't think Chris Cooper does a bad job. It's boring.
Yeah.
I feel like the character doesn't really register for me because Chris Cooper's performance doesn't really register for
me.
It's hard for me to walk away from this really seeing the depth of their relationship because he's almost a non-entity in the role.
Yeah.
And what I get from them, I get because of Prosper's monologues.
I think Trinculo and Stefano are interesting. I think Alfred Molina brings more menace to Stefano than necessarily exists, and I think Russell Brand brings more naivety and innocence to Trinculo than necessarily could be interpreted in the play. Mm-hmm. I think there are both choices that maybe Tamor helped them make, or they made on their own, but I think that you could easily do a version where Stefano was just drunk and Trinculo was a bit more savvy.
Yeah.
But he... I think they both... whoever made those choices, they execute them very well.
Yeah, they do. Russell Brand manages to like he makes Trinculo look like, oh, he's just kind of like an adorable idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just along for the ride. Poor guy. And Stefano is frankly a little disturbing.
Yeah.
And that it has played
a little more manipulative.
Yeah.
We've encountered Russell Brand twice now on this podcast, and every time you've liked his performance.
As a person, he's got issues.
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Oh, yes, of course.
I think he's a fine entertainer. I think that as a person, he's kind of a cunt sometimes. Mm. Maybe we should cut that word out on a U.S. podcast, but...
No, that's fine.
You said it, not me.
He's a terror... But I think he can stick his foot in it a lot.
No, that is true.
I think he gets compliments when compliments are due. He's famously, in The Big Fat Quiz of the Year a lot, which is, a U.K. panel show thing, and I laugh at his jokes. He can be very funny. He can also be annoying.
It occurred to me that him and Helen Mirren are reunited in that Arthur remake.
I forgot
that existed until right now.
I'm kind of fascinated. I know it's bad, but
do you want to see it?
I kind of want to see it.
Is it good?
I don't think it's
no.
good.
No, it can't be.
I'll watch it.
But the gender swapping
is interesting.
An interesting concept.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Russell Brand on paper, it's an interesting Dudley Moore replacement.
Yeah, yes, it is.
I agree.
Anyway,
I don't think there's anyone equal to Liza Minnelli in that movie.
I mean, we can even move faster through these. David Strathairn does a fine job. He doesn't have much to do but be sad.
The rest of them just have to mope and be sad.
Yeah. I do he has a good presence, though.
Reed Carney and Felicity Jones.
I feel bad for them.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. This is not the time that you had to act. You just had to be stupid.
Right. You're driftwood in this movie.
They had to be very pretty, warm bodies.
Yeah.
And they had to have beautiful eyes and big lips, and they just had
to
kind of...
We've both seen Reeve Carney and Felicity Jones do acting, and we know
they
can do it.
Yeah. They don't really register.
Yeah.
I just feel like I feel like Julie Tamor was just like, I don't care.
I feel also there's not really a way to make them more compelling than they are as written. So it's just kind of again, that's why you need to keep the scenes moving as quickly as possible with them. Because otherwise you're going to get fucking bored looking at
them. I'd love to see a director and actors that make that role actually.
I'd be interested in seeing how you could do it.
I feel like you would have to come up with entirely new scenes.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. There might be a way, but I'm not the director clearly to do it. So I'd like to see someone try.
That's all I have to say.
Meryl Streep playing all roles.
The movie as it stands.
Looking to score real quick, Elliot Goldenthal did the score for this. Yes. Yeah. So he is Julie Taymor's longtime lover/partner. So they've been together forever, and he has scored almost all of her movies.
possibly all. He has That's done scores. Tough. He's a really interesting composer sometimes, and he's done some really weird scores that really work. This is not at all one of them. This score is fucking bizarre.
The guitar riffs are horrendous.
So it starts off kind of weird. It's just a lot of like in the opening of the movie, whenever she's causing the storm. It's kind of like, okay, like this is fine. This is acceptable.
We go all over the place.
Right. And then we cut to the scene again where Ben Whishaw is enormous and poking the ship, causing a sound of fire. And there is like electric guitar riffs. These come up again whenever he is playing the harpy. Mm-hmm. There is a theme for like Trinculo and Stefano.
Like jazzy.
Yeah, this weird. Yeah. And then especially at the like,
it's the Cowboy Bebop.
It's weird. Like, yeah, it's an intermittent. Yeah. It's a weird intermittent like.
Yeah.
And then like at the, then at the end where they're being chased by bees, it's like almost Yakety Sax. Like, you could completely dub it over with Yakety Sax and get the same results. So like, much in the sense that this movie is an inconsistent, weird misfire, the score really reflects that.
It's also it's just not pleasant to listen to.
Yeah.
And it's not bad in an interesting way. It's not discordant in an interesting way.
The one time the music is on point for the scene is the speech. Again, the speech was done well.
Yes.
Which...
The fire circle speech.
Yeah.
Where it's just sort of like drums and like...
Right. No, there are moments that work really well. And then there are moments that are just like bizarre and you wonder what anyone was thinking of proving this.
Do you think
this.
It was a money issue?
No.
Music
is all synths. That was all like...
Yeah, I'm sure that he got the score that he 100% wanted for this movie.
Okay.
I think the special effects are a money issue. Other things might be a money issue. That is 100% what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Sorry. So we wrapped it up.
We are ready.
We're wrapped.
We are ready to talk about fixes.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm ready to go first.
Go first.
I'm happy to go.
I'm ready to go second.
I'll go
last because I've got the least. Last and least, baby.
I tried to write stuff down. I really did, but I didn't really get that far because I was doing a lot of other things and like eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I have some solid thoughts about this. So real quick, I want to say, I think if you were Julie Taymor, if I was Julie Taymor, and I still have this crazy idea to do The Tempest the way she did it, I think there are a few simple things that you could do if you're willing to be a little bit more liberal that you could do if you wanted Caliban to be Digimon Hansu and you wanted to be Black Native. I think you would take out any implication that he tried to rape the daughter.
I agree.
I think that you would admit that. I think that you would maybe add a layer of ambiguity that, like, maybe there's an implication that he did bad things, but maybe that's not, maybe he's not believed.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, the white daughter is believed over this native of, like, accusations that, like, he stole or did anything. I don't want to get hairy with sexual accusations there because I don't want to step all the way into, like, let's not believe victims.
Yeah.
But I think that you could do some interesting stuff with, like, we don't believe, like...
The black guy.
A black guy.
Yeah.
And I think that you could play up an element that I think exists somewhat with Helen Mirren and Digimon Hansu in the movie, where there's a layer of, like, I don't want to admit that I'm doing this to this guy, and it's a little shameful, but I do need him. And there's, like, lines in the play. I think it's an interesting dynamic that you can work up, like, at some level that she knows exactly what she's doing to this guy, and that it's shameful, but also she doesn't want to stop doing it, because it's beneficial to her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like the way that, even though it takes out some of the context of the play to emit the line of, like, I forgive you, I kind of like the way that she, in the play, in the movie as is, like, just looks at him and allows him to leave, because it's kind of like she can't get herself to say that out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he just gets, sort of, like, sort of wanders off. Anyway, were this my own thing, there's a couple things that I would do with Ariel and Caliban. So there's that the famous, like, post-colonial interpretation that we talked about. In that, they also sort of talk about Ariel as a contrast, as sort of, like, a good servant, who's, like, acquiescent and gets to be the house slave or whatever, and, like, is hoping to negotiate for freedom versus, like, you know, the rebellious Caliban type. There's also the alternate interpretation of, like, Ariel and Caliban as, like, the selves, which I was kind of fascinated with. So, like, this would be, like, Ariel's more of, like, the superego, and Caliban's more of, like, this base nature, like, the id.
Yeah.
So playing that up a little bit more, I think, is how I would do this. Things that I was thinking about is that, based on the way that the timeline of the play works out, Ariel would technically have been present for the entirety of Miranda's upbringing and could almost be seen like a second parent, invisible though he or she might be. Presumably was instrumental in helping to raise Miranda, because, like, the way that Prosper relies on Ariel throughout the whole play implies that, like, has relied on Ariel for this long. Also, I kind of like the idea of there being elements of, like, either Prospera and Ariel and Caliban being part of the same thing, or there being, like, a shared element between them. So I'd kind of depict Ariel as Feyenerys, but showing signs of, like, decay or age from the time spent with Prospera, as if to say that, like, this used to be a thing of air and spirit, but is becoming a bit more... It's sort of sinking into Prospera.
Interesting.
Out of time. And that could... And then you could get into why there's, like, a layer of empathy and humanity to Ariel, which I think I would play up. I would kind of want to do Ariel as more of a human figure than a spirit. And Caliban, interestingly, like, with the way that Julie Taymor does him with, like, the splotches of, like, whites, I kind of like the idea that maybe he's, like, more, rather than being, like, the way that, like, or a person of color that's, like, with weird deformities, I kind of want to depict him at a base level as, like, exotic, built and rough, to Ariel being, like, smooth and, like, airy and thing, but, like, he would show signs of, like, more grooming or perfection from the time, because he partially was, like, educated and, like, trained, and there are elements of him that are more, like, tame than from his, like, former wild self. And so there, again, sort of, maybe somehow you could connect that with color or clothing to, like, Prospera, so that it's more apparent, this connection between the three of them, that, like, Prospera's in between the two of them, and there are elements that, like, cross over, like a gradient. I kind of like if Ariel is since she or he is invisible for most of the play, I think I would definitely keep it opposite gender, and I do like Prospera, so I'd probably keep him as a guy. I was saying this in the earlier bits, that I kind of want Ariel to be a silent witness to a lot of the stuff, and I think there's a lot of opportunity to throw him in to other scenes. He doesn't have to speak. He could just, like, react and sort of mime it out. And I think you'd get a lot more... Since he's basically the second main character of the play, you could do a lot with that. It'd actually be nice to see him... I don't know if there is a moment in the play where Prosper's truly by herself and not actually speaking to Ariel, but I would love if there were, if Ariel could get sort of his own, whether it's silent or not, moment of reflection towards Prospera, just similar to how she does to other characters. Because I think the two of them are the ones that are, like, the know-all, like, we know what's going on characters, and I think that they're, the relationship they share, I want to play up. I think that I would play up a sort of ambiguous, loving relationship that they have, because I think they were the closest person that they have to each other for the 12 years they've been together, presumably. And yeah, other than that, I don't really know what else, like, I think, I guess on a base, like, an easy level, like, you could cut more with Trinculo and Stefano. I kind of see Trinculo as more of the traditional Shakespeare servant character. There's dumb things he does that make him look more of a fool. But I think that, again, he's kind of a bit savvier, and I would probably play that up more. And I would probably keep Stefano as just, like, a really weird drunk guy.
Yeah.
It might involve changing it a lot, but I don't know. I think it makes more sense for Caliban to be the primary driver and instigator of revenge, and Stefano and Trinculo both being like, oh, sure, but being just sort of drunk and not really understanding or believing it to be like, yeah, we're really going to go kill this woman. But I really like the idea in the end of Prospera coming to terms with, like, Caliban is a thing that she created, and is a thing that she must own and deal with.
I like that.
So it's also, interestingly, like, the way that she forgets that it happens is interesting, because it's the one thing that she didn't plan for. Like, everything in the play is like, this is exactly going as planned, but she didn't really think about these two idiots finding Caliban and Caliban being like, let's go kill her. And so... it's probably better to play that off as, like, a third act surprise, other than this, the way it happens in the movie and the play is just weird, where she's just, like, all
oh,
of a
right,
sudden,
by the way.
This happens.
Yeah.
It feels like Shakespeare himself forgot it was
happening. Yeah. So in terms of, like, keeping to a three act structure, it would make for a good, like, all was lost moment, where it's like, oh, no, everything that I've done could fall apart because I didn't think about this awful person who I've mistreated actually doing something to stop me. Anyway, that's sort of my rambling thoughts on how I would interpret this play.
All right. I have mine boiled down.
Sure.
Oh, also, yes to all of that.
It's the easiest executive meeting I've ever had.
Yeah.
Yes to all of that,
I have no notes.
Have some money.
Include a dog. Anyway, okay. I went in a very different interpretive direction. When Lee and I were in Toronto and I saw that portrait of the Marquesa Casati inside the Art Gallery of Ontario, and it's like a really powerful portrait, and I did research on her and I thought she led this really fascinating life. During her lifetime, she lived on Capri, where a lot of other artists and homosexuals had been exiled from Europe, and they were all kind of living there in a colony that she just sort of funded out of pocket, and she actually blew most of her money on it. That's going to be my setting for my take on The Tempest.
Ouch.
I think I'm going to maybe not stick with the Shakespearean script. I think I'm just going to probably follow the arc of the story more or less, but to kind of switch it out as more of a exploring these historical characters through the plot of The Tempest. I mean, the Cassati had a daughter, so, I mean, she didn't go with her to Capri, but in this version she will have. And
so hang on, sorry. So is this literally this person, or is this a character based on this person?
It will be literally this person.
All right,
in
continue.
Place of Prospero. I'm running with it.
All right, run.
But she did also have a rich and powerful husband who disapproved of basically everything she did. So in this, it'll be like husband and cronies are the ones that she's like washed up on the island, and Ariel is just her like, you know,
her twink,
her twinkie BFF. Then she's setting up to do this stuff. But I would kind of want her to realize like, wow, I should maybe kind of let you live your own life, Ariel, and actually be able to do things for yourself and not just have to carry out my like powerful rich white lady.
So you're suggesting that this white lady like enslaves a twink
like
on her island and then realizes
enslaves.
That like maybe this isn't a good thing that I did.
Not literally enslaves, but like the way I'm thinking of it is that she probably like lets it go to her head, like, look at this nice thing I'm doing for these people, without maybe realizing that she's just sort of hoarding them around a lot. I think it is a pretty apt space to kind of do a different take on a fairy island, just because, yeah, gay people, but also like, Cassati was nuts. She had like leopards and monkeys and live snakes as jewelry and all this stuff. Like, that's sufficiently weird to kind of approximate, in my opinion, magic. And I think the fact that this was an artist colony could be the same, and you could have a lot of fun with how that would look and sound and the kind of people that might be there. I think that would be a lot of fun. Done.
All right, touche. So I didn't really do a whole thing this time for whatever reason. I'm not quite sure why. I think in general, I'm probably less, I don't want to say like I don't care for Shakespeare, but I'm definitely less of a fan than say Lee is, I think, mm-hmm. of his works. So when I was watching this and when I was thinking about it, the three characters who interested me most are the ones who are on the cover of the Blu-ray, which is to say Prospera, Caliban, and Ariel. Like, for all the emphasis that this seems to put on the three of them, one of them is drastically underserved in terms of the plot, which is obviously Caliban.
Yeah.
There is an interesting sort of idea that, Lee, you had brought up also, that there are two different types of slaves as you're looking at them, where there's the one who's kind of like acquiescing constantly to their master and like trying to get in their good graces, mm-hmm. and then they'll become free because their master is so pleased with them. The other one who's just fucking pissed as hell to be enslaved and wants nothing to do with it and only does things under the force of like physical torment, basically. Mm-hmm. The relationship that these two characters potentially have is fascinating to me, which is to say the relationship between Ariel and Caliban. We never see them interact at all in the movie. I don't know if they interact at all in the play. I don't remember. If there is ever really a scene of the two of them one-on-one.
Ariel doesn't talk to anyone.
Right.
Except for when he's the harpy.
Right. So I think there's a potentially really fascinating relationship there. And I think that my version of The Tempest would still have everything else going on to an extent. The things with Miranda and Ferdinand and the Duke and the King and all that other crap going on. But I want to place more of an emphasis on the relationship between Ariel and Caliban. So I want more scenes of them interacting. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the movie, there needs to be sort of... So if we interpret The Tempest as Shakespeare talking about how like this is affect how writing and being a playwright has affected his life in some way, and that's what he's putting onto Prospero, I don't think it ends with him really being like, boy, I fucked up in some pretty bad ways. It ends with him being like, well, maybe I did, but meh, and then kind of leaving at the end of it.
Interesting.
So I think there needs to be some sort of fall. Like, maybe you actually see the fact that like this character really regrets what they've actually done to like these other people. There's no real fallout. So I also want like the last scene of the play should really be something between Ariel and Caliban talking about how like they've both been affected by this sort of thing.
Ooh.
And maybe now like, you know, they are free to go about their own lives, but Caliban's like, yeah, well, I'm sorry, I have like basically PTSD because I've been forced to carry firewood around for 18 years or whatever. Like, it's great that, you know, you were this airy little thing who was going off to do whatever her whims were, but like, I'm like, this made me fucking physically miserable. So like, this is all well and good for you. Like, you're this air spirit who can go fly away. This is my island. She came in here. This affected me in this way. And now I have to deal with like
everything that has happened to me since then, and I can't go anywhere else. Like, where the hell am I supposed to go? I can't go to Naples.
Really interesting.
Yeah, and so, like, I want this to be a focus on the three of them more so than ever. I don't think that I would adhere strictly to Shakespearean language. The one thing I was thinking of is the movie My Own Private Idaho, and I don't even know if I would say it does this entirely well, mm-hmm. but that movie does a lot of, like, normal everyday dialogue, and then periodically the characters just lapse into Shakespeare or Shakespearean-style mm-hmm. monologues. And so I think that might be sort of an interesting thing to keep a certain number of, like, choice monologues in the movie, like, really effective, really powerful, really notable ones, and then do your own thing for the rest of the plot as you need to.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Yeah, it's interesting. That made me think of something that I forgot to mention earlier, if I may be allowed.
Yeah.
That's fine. The fact that he doesn't speak, I think it's a solid choice to break that and have him interact with their characters, in particular Caliban. I think that I would keep it. I like that Ariel doesn't speak to anyone except Prospero. I kind of like the idea that, again, I think it's more, I think the giving up of power and or writing is whatever you're imagining that Prospero is giving up. I like the idea that it's also giving up Ariel,
mm-hmm.
that's giving up this relationship that you have with this person. In the metaphor of, like, it's writing, it's creativity, or, like, whatever metaphor you want to make, I don't really know what the difference is, like, what Caliban represents per se.
No, I don't quite either.
Which is a kind of weird thing to say, but I think that, like, on a greater macro level, like, Caliban would represent, like, the things you stepped on to get where you were.
Yeah.
And Ariel is, like, the joy you did, the joy you have in doing the thing you like, and giving up that joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I like personifying that as, like, this person that only you know. It's, like, the way that you interact with, like, your imagination, or, like... So that's why I think I would definitely keep it as, like, there's... Not even Miranda ever has spoken or seen Ariel. Like, it's just this person that only Ariel and Prospero, they only know each other in certain ways.
I have another reading just to put out there, and this is neither here nor there, I guess, but, like, is there an idea similar to how, like, if Caliban is the id and Ariel is the superego,
mm-hmm.
Ariel is released at the end.
Caliban is also pardoned explicitly in the play.
Yes, but if let's assume that they stay on the island, it's almost like Prospero decides, I'm gonna, like, live and ruminate on my sins. And, like,
I never took it as Ariel stays on the island, though, so much.
No, Caliban stays on the island, Ariel's gone.
Okay, I thought you meant both of them stay on the island.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think part of the epilogue that they don't do in the movie, because it's, like, sort of Prospero to the audience, is deliberately, like, Prospero saying, like, I know that I've done wrong things, and he asks the audience to basically forgive him, to allow him to return to his former life. And so I think that while it's hard to work that into a movie when there's no audience, per se, that you can address, I feel like that should be an important part of every interpretation of this knowledge, this acknowledgement from Prospero.
I almost went, I almost would have preferred if she had said it to Ariel and Caliban or something.
Yeah,
or something.
It might make sense, right? Like,
yeah,
if she was saying, like,
regardless of whether or not Caliban could find it to actually forgive her, like,
yeah.
Probably, I wouldn't blame him for not doing it, but, like, I feel like her attempt to sort of reconcile her sins in some way is an important part of her character, and to me, the movie's ending, honestly, it feels a little abrupt in some
it
ways,
is.
And I think it's because of that.
I think
yeah.
you can compare it a lot to The Count of Monte Cristo, because at heart it is another form of a revenge story.
Yeah, that's true.
And there are both elements of, like, to get the revenge or to get the thing you want, you're going to have to step on some faces.
Right. The difference, of course, this one where she or he is almost immediately like, well, I guess I can forgive you because, like, I mean, I'm not saying she has, like, a bad reason for forgiving them, but, like, at the end she makes the decision too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, so I think it's part, yeah, that's a good note. I think that probably it's one of the important things you should include is an acknowledgement from the main character of like, that they have done some shit to get to this point, and
yeah.
that they also need to be allowed to be forgiven.
Yeah.
By the other characters. That's all I got.
And
guys,
would we recommend we see this? Another person see this movie?
I think if you're a fan of Shakespeare, it's worth seeing.
It is worth seeing if you're a fan of Shakespeare, for sure. And I think if you're not a fan of Shakespeare, it's still... I mean, I wouldn't steer you to it as your only Shakespeare movie, because it's not going to turn you on.
There's others.
Yeah.
I would say...
Tune in 2 weeks for what others there might be.
I would say yes, because, including Lee's point, but also, even when Julie Taymor doesn't really get it quite right,
mm-hmm.
I still think, like, good or bad, what she does is interesting.
Yeah.
And it's never... Like, her artistic choices can be very weird and, in my opinion, sort of, like, janky or cheap-looking. But I think it's always, she's always trying something wild, and I think that should be commended.
I think if you were familiar with the work of Julie Taymor and you do not at all care for her, this is not something you should seek out.
No.
Like, this is truly just more Julie Taymor. And again, if the thought of hearing people speak in Shakespearean Elizabethan sonnets is something that makes your flesh crawl, you won't get anything from this either.
No.
So like, you have to be open to both of those two concepts to see it. I don't know if I would recommend it to most people for that reason. I'm glad that I saw it because it's interesting and weird. You know, again, as we said, Helen Mirren delivers a very worthy performance as Prospera, but it's a strange, not entirely successful attempt to tell the story of the Tempest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the birds agree too.
Birds have thoughts.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for us, guys.
Yep.
Tune in 2 weeks. We'll be actually doing a little bit more about Shakespeare, hear about what we're going to be doing next.
Mm-hmm.
Visit us at facebook.com/ywatch. Drop us a like.
Facebook.com/ywatchpodcast.
Sure. Listen to us.
Yeah.
Like us.
Like us. Love us.
Like us, Daddy.
Yeah.
Like us, Father.
Clap for us if you forgive our sins.
Clap for us if you forgive our sins.
All right, let's clap it out, everyone.
Bye. Bye.